Farmer.
Hi. So most of my presentation is going to be view graphs, even though that's not the format David prefers. But in small deference to him, I thought I'd start out by outlining on the blackboard just what the contents of physics today are, because we find over the years that people may read physics today but don't always make a distinction between which sections are where. And in telling you about the different sections, I can also tell you about opportunities for you to contribute. We're always happy to have you do that. So if you open a typical book, the first thing you come to is a one-page section called Physics Update. Usually these are reworked pieces. They're just one paragraph each on about four different topics of some interest. Usually they're not, they haven't risen to the level of significance where we do a major news story on them. But they're usually nevertheless interesting little pieces of work. They're taken from a larger compilation called Physics News Update that's generated by the American Institute of Physics and is on their website every week. And some of you may have those emailed to you. So that's staff written. And then there's a reference frame. This is the only section of the magazine for which we have a regular stable of contributors. You have to be asked to be a contributor to reference frame. And we try to maintain a representation of different fields. We pick some spokespeople within those fields who write well and have some originality in thinking. So for years you've been reading David Merman, say, or Leo Kadnoff, or Phil Anderson, and so forth. So, you know, if you ever had any suggestions for that section, you could feed them through me. Letters is an ever popular section where anyone can write in, and they do. If we make a mistake, they're quick to notify us of it. But it's usually fun to read just because of the controversies that go on there. Then we get to the new sections, which are staff written. There's search and discovery, which is the news of physics research. And there's something called issues and events, which is about the sort of softer side of the science. Issues and events will cover, say, government news, physics, science, government policy as it affects physics research, funding, education, institutional questions like, you know, CERN or the CERN Board of Governors, things like that. Both of these are staff written, but in both of them, we really rely heavily on the community, as I'll elaborate later, and feeding us ideas for stories and talking to us about the issues and then checking our stories with us. Then we have the feature articles, which are written by experts in the field. There's usually about three per issue. And these, of course, are things that any one of you would be a candidate to write. Many of them we get by soliciting them. We find that a field has reached a certain level of maturity, or maybe there's a field that's coming along that many people don't know about. Be worthwhile to have a review article on them. Unlike search and discovery stories, which focus on the research of usually focus on a specific piece of work or several recent experiments, articles tend to be longer reviews of a whole subject. And so we solicit many of those, but in many cases we have people write to us and say, I'd like to write an article on this topic, and here's why it's exciting and why you might want to have an article about it. And then we can negotiate with that person about what aspects of the topic they might want to cover. So we really appreciate getting ideas like that. We don't accept them all. Sometimes we say maybe not now, but later. But it's great to have that kind of input. And the, another category, sometimes people just send us an article out of the blue. Some of those we accept. It gives us less flexibility in dealing with the articles if they're already written. If you had an idea for an article, it's better to contact us and we'd work with you in developing the article. Then we have book reviews. We have we receive an examination copies from most of the major publishers. We can only review about a tenth of the books that we receive. So we have a stable of people who advise us on which books that we ought to review and who would be good reviewers. If you in general are interested in reviewing books, as opposed to interested in reviewing a specific book, you might want to contact us so we know, you know, that you're someone that we might call on to review. We just don't, we're a little leery of people who say, well, I want to review this book. For obvious reasons. Sometimes they might want to push it, sometimes they might want to can it. So, book reviews, and then we have We Hear That, which is sort of the gossip section. It has job changes, awards, and also under that topic is the obituary section. And we've never really liked running obituaries under the We Hear That name, and we haven't come up with a better idea. Someone along the lines suggested that we call the whole section Riffs and Stiffs. But we haven't had any better idea, so it's remained for I don't know how many years this way. Again, lots of people write in notices of job changes. We're sort of hit and miss whether we get those. We also appreciate learning of eminent physicists who have passed away so we can commission an obituary for them. And, opinion piece. Opinion piece is not a regular column, but when someone from the community has a thoughtful piece on a topic of significance and it's well written, then we sometimes suggest it be an opinion piece. Sometimes there's a letter that we think is so well written that ought to be worked into an opinion piece. So that's another opportunity for you to contribute. Okay, so now I'm going to go to the view graphs and tell you about how I do my job, which is reporting for the news section. And that's primarily what I've done for them since I began with them some years ago. Now, someone who's fairly tall, could you bring down this screen for me?
Barbara, could we have questions on...
Absolutely. Please. Yeah, that's the whole idea of these talks.
Can you move the projector back up?
Oh. Well.
Well, we can look at it. The comment I would make is the letters section in recent years sometimes has got quite technical, and almost people submitting papers, research papers there, and people even refer to these letters in Physics Today and stuff like that.
I didn't realize.
It's a bad trend. I mean, the editor is maybe not you, but the editor is a PRL. I mean, viewing you as a canonical.
Right.
Editor.
No. I appreciate that. That's I really love feedback like this.
Yeah.
And that I agree with you, there's a lot of concern.
In other words, we do have comments in physical review letters sections and stuff like that for a lot of those comments.
Mm-hmm.
And people have formulas and data and often it's really quite sort of iconoclastic and individual, and it's, but it's got the imprimatur of the Physics Today. I don't have a physical review letter, but I have a letter to Physics Today.
I have a Physics Today letter. I didn't realize that, so that's something of which they should be aware. Very often I'll review those and I'll say, this is original research. It doesn't belong in physics today. And we ought to be saying that more often.
Particularly you're saying. About priorities often.
Mm-hmm.
And
Right.
I find the series of reference frame
yes.
wonderful, and I think you should consider publishing series as books. For instance, personally, I have the series of reference frames of Dan Kleppner.
Yes.
And I like to have them collected in a single package. I think if you would consider publishing it as a book.
I'm going to have to take notes here.
Would be
useful.
In my opinion, many people would buy it, provided that it is not too expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. I think David Mervyn did actually publish
this
as a book in India.
Yeah. The Bujins or something like that. Bujins. Yeah.
For this series, for instance, I think it would be a wonderful
book. Good suggestion.
Are the reference frame articles refereed?
Not formally. Most everything in the magazine, though, gets some kind of outside. Very often we'll send something outside. All the articles, when we get them in, we have them reviewed by two people on the outside and several people on the inside that is among the staff. And very often the reference frame will be refereed. Sometimes they might raise an issue that we see some sensitivity with, and we'll send it out to someone for a comment. Okay, so here's the very first Physics Today. Get this on the other side. Which came out in May of 1948, so we recently celebrated our 50th anniversary. I haven't been working for them quite that long. What? Oh, I'm sorry. That's Oppenheimer's hat on one of the pipes of the Lawrence Ray, one of the early cyclotrons. Here's our more modern look. And of course, a question I very often get is, how did I get the job working for Physics Today? In 1969, I was still working on my PhD thesis at SLAC. My husband had already waited for me a year, and he says, I've got to take this job at Bell Labs. I'm moving east. How about you? So I said, okay, I'll move, and I'll just get a teaching job, which is what I always wanted to do. And I applied to all these schools, and it was a really bad time to get a job in physics. I had some school from Montclair State College says, well, normally we don't get any applicants at all, but this year it's been raining application like cats and dogs. So weren't too many jobs around. But just about when I was feeling very discouraged, I saw an ad in Physics Today. Now, I've written this out, and you'll immediately notice the difference in language style. But this was an editorial about the job situation, in which the editor was saying, well, you know, if physicists are having a hard time finding jobs, they shouldn't consider themselves so narrowly trained. They should consider a wider variety of vocations. But in this sentence, it is hard to accept that in a world full of need, a man educated in physics can do only what he has been doing and has no skills to offer where needs are greatest. In a time when national unemployment is at record low, must we believe that physicists are less employable than the average man? Well, I looked beyond that language. And I think at the time I really wasn't aware of that. Maybe we were just inured to it at that point. But I wrote to in the same issue, they had an advertisement for a position opening at Physics Today. It said, junior editor to concentrate on technical reporting, bachelor and master in physics preferred, ability to write essential. So I said, well, I wrote to him and I said, you're right, we shouldn't consider ourselves narrowly trained. You should consider that I'm really qualified for your job. So So I did get it after having first to written passed a writing test. I had to write a sample news story. But fortunately, we've modernized our language since then. So it's been a great job. Some of the advantages, the main one is I'm paid to learn, and it's wonderful. I'm paid to keep up with physics. I don't know it very deep or very well. You can, but I've been able to pay to keep abreast of a wide variety of topics. And I couldn't do the job if I didn't have the help of the community, and they're always very cooperative. I'm able to, you know, unlike a term paper in college where you could only just refer to books, I could call up anybody I want to and say, I'm from physics today, and they perk up their ears and they're happy to talk to me because we appreciate that kind of cooperation. And I started working for home in 1971 when my first child was born. So it's been a good telecommuting job too. My office normally is in the basement of our home.
What is the actual main office?
Their editorial offices are in College Park, Maryland at the American Center for Physics. Yeah. This is just showing me hobnobbing with the rich and famous. And that's Hans Demelt and Val Fitch on the occasion of the Nobel Jubilee in 1991. They were celebrating 90 years of Nobel Prize, and they asked me to come. So that was kind of fun. Okay, so I wanted to concentrate in this talk telling you how we go about writing the news stories, how we go about, first of all, finding what we're going to write about and some of the challenges we face. Can we just take time to, Jason, to wend his way in here? Okay. So the first challenge is that we're monthly, and there's just no way in the world we're going to have the news on headlines the day after it happens. For example, we have to send our stories to the printer on the 12th of the month for the issue to come out the following month, so that if the Higgs boson were discovered on the day that you receive your issue of Physics Today, there's just no way we could get that in for another month. So we have this problem of timeliness.
Question on this, yeah. Physics Today is on the web now.
Yes.
I forget, do you have an update section?
Put little blurbs. When the Nobel Prizes come out, we usually quickly put a little notice in with a link to something more to read. When the top quark was found, we had just sent the issue to the printer, but we found room to add a little paragraph in blue pages telling about the top quark and promising a longer article. So we can, if it's something important, do a little update with link. What we have to do is really hope that we have enough value added to our stories so that even, you know, you're not going to learn about something for the first time for Physics Today, but hopefully you'll learn about it in some kind of depth or some kind of perspective that you wouldn't otherwise get. Another just comment about timeliness. It really has helped us to have things like the preprint archive on the web, because we can get know of stories well before publication, and that enables us to get a head start on a story so that we can get it done so that it comes in sooner. Working against that are the embargoes imposed by Science and Nature, by which officially, we don't learn about the story till the week before it's published, and then we have to start learning about it and reporting on it, and it's another delay. What I tell people if they do have a paper they're sending to Science and Nature is that we honor the embargo, but it helps if I can get the story before the time of the embargo, so I can be doing the reporting, learning the material, so I can write it fast. There's just no way we're going to beat Nature and Science to the press, so that's, I don't think they worry about our violating their embargo. Okay, this is just an example of a story that where we, I think we had value added. This is a cold fusion story where, you know, the whole world knew about cold fusion before Physics Today had an article about it. But by the time we did write it, we were able to talk to researchers around the world and bring together a lot of the evidence for and against and talk to many people about it. So we hope the value added is there.
You can give a two-year-old
elegy. Yeah, that
disappeared.
That pretty much was an elegy, that piece. So it was a more recent one on sauna fusion. Picking the story. This is probably the toughest part of the job. Is I call it breakthroughs or breakdowns. The breakthroughs are easy to spot. The breakdowns are a little more subtle. Usually, most of the stories are between those two. There are stories where they're interesting, they're significant in their own field. Maybe we have a vast middle. We have to choose. There probably is some kind of imperfect selection there. But what we do to pick the stories is we read the journals. We go to the meetings. But I think the best, and we read press releases. And I have to say, we get more information now than ever before. Because Physical Review Letters invites anyone who has publishing an article in there to write a little popular summary. And those are available to us before PRL comes out. And then Science and Nature send their press releases. And there's stuff on the archive. So it's not a matter of not knowing this, what's happening. It's a matter of sorting through everything and picking the most significant things. So that's where the community really helps out. First of all, a lot of people will write to us, dash me an email, and alert me to something. And I like to be so alerted. We don't promise to write about everything that people alert us to, but we will check it out. And then the other way is once we get an idea that something might be exciting, we pick up the phone and call this hypothetical neutral observer, which is somebody who knows about the work but isn't directly involved, so we don't think has an axe to grind or a position to push. So we try to find these people. It's not all that always easy. And we try to find two people who can pretty objectively comment and say that the work is really significant. It really deserves a story. We try to pick them on who have different perspectives on the story. So some things are no-brainers. Here's a breakthrough, the COBE measurement of the anisotropy and the background radiation. I think it was clear to most people that this was really exciting stuff. A colleague of mine who was in the room when the graph was shown on the screen said the audience immediately broke into applause and stood up and standing ovation for the researchers. So we got that one right. Here's one that I thought I had right, but it turns out eventually that I didn't. This is work by Shun, Clock, and Batlog that we since have learned is fabricated data at best. this in particular was a story where they had discovered that three organic materials, pentosine, tetrazine, and anthracene, can both superconduct and laze. And it was really exciting stuff. And I had made my requisite 2 or 3 phone calls. Everybody I talked to was very excited about the work. I picked this particular page to show you because here's an example. I don't want to single anyone out, but Fred Woodall of UCLA says, this is a terrific piece of work. It's going to engender a great deal of physics. And you know, he wasn't alone. A lot of people at that time were saying, this is great stuff. And I published 4 stories on this group. There was this one, and before then, they had shown the quantum...
Did he get anybody at that time in that story slightly suspiciously?
No, I had no inkling in my... Then, you know, a little later, I wrote about buckyballs, superconducting. Again, it's no question. But around that time, I started to get people a little bit uncomfortable that it hadn't been... Or frustrated, is maybe a better word, that it hadn't been verified. And then I guess it's my assurance that the system worked in some way. Just after that buckyball story, a few months later, there was a report that the self-assembled monolayers of organic materials constituted a field effect transistor. When I made calls about this piece of work, that was the first time I got people saying, we don't believe it. They said, okay, we don't believe the interpretation of that. We think they're wrong in terms of what they think is happening physically. They said these molecules, if you work with them, this paper was reporting these molecules were standing up between 2 plates. And he says, if you put those molecules on the bottom plate, they lie down. He says, you can't get them to stand up like that. So I didn't write about this one. And then soon after, of course, we had the commission investigating these people, and by the time this thing now has this disclaimer about that this paper has been subject to an inquiry commissioned by Bell Labs. So that was a sad story in physics, and hopefully we don't make too many mistakes that bad. But you know, there is this problem. We do have to rely on the community for. In the community's judgment. Okay, well, then I pick a story, and then I have to write about it. And that's what I call the jargon jungle, because here's this topic I've never often haven't tackled before, and I have to plow through the jargon and the technical stuff and find out what was really done. So usually I get a general review article in the field if there is one. I'll read the paper, the relevant experimental or theoretical papers many times and underline things and get questions in the margin. So I'm focused on what I want to ask. And then this is where it's a wonderful thing that I can call anybody and say, can you explain this to me? And I learned long ago that the dumber I act, the better the answers I'll get. I just have to swallow my pride and say, you know, I have no idea what you're talking about. Can we go slower? Can we back up? Can we draw a picture of this? Whatever it takes. Because if I don't understand it, I just can't write about it at a level that someone else is going to understand. And there are these huge gaps between what physicists in one discipline knows and what someone in another discipline knows. Now, my example of this jargon jungle, with apologies of a few people in this room, is a story on string theory. Actually, I'm showing this also because it was KIPT enabled me to get this story. I'd come out to a conference they had on superstrings. And they had everyone at the conference very excited by something called the Maldacena conjecture. They were even dancing the Maldacena at their banquet. It was a conjecture that linked 10-dimensional string theory to 4-dimensional quantum chromodynamics. But I had to tackle terms like Dirichlet. Boundary conditions, D brains, P brains, anti-de Sitter space. This one was really tough. pulled an all-nighter for this one. So, getting the physics straight, though, is only half the problem, it turns out. I learned really early on that you have to also learn the context, because there's some real sensitive egos out there. So I have to learn, in what way should I present the physics? Do I say this is just unquestionably the hottest thing since sliced bread, or that this is pretty important, but you know it needs this and this and this to be shown to be really valid? So you have to put it in the proper context. So the tone with which you write the story is important. But more than that, or especially important, is to get the credit straight. That we all know physics isn't done in a vacuum, and for every piece of work there's something that came before it. So we have to make sure that we understand the history leading to the current piece of work that we're covering. And any related work, sometimes someone else is doing another experiment that they may think is exactly the same thing, but others think that it's not quite as significant for this reason or that reason, and you have to find a diplomatic way to express that. And then there's people who don't agree with your take on a story, or that disagree with other people who are writing about this, you know, about whom you're writing. But let me just give you my example here. This is a story about the evidence that was accumulating in the early 90s about the nature of the pairing state in high-temperature superconductors. They were they knew the electrons paired, but they didn't know whether they paired isotropically, like an S wave, as in the conventional superconductors, or in a more complicated D wave pattern. And they just had a series of really nice experiments. And we're suggesting that the pairing was D-wave. But there was one, I think at least one experiment that was still saying S-wave. And there, this is something, I guess my earlier introduction to this controversy, one of the most fun ones I did early on was writing the discovery of the J and Psi particles, just nearly simultaneously at MIT and SLAC. And I think I very carefully had, you know, one paragraph for them, one paragraph for you, one for you, one for you. The only thing I did wrong, I feel very bad about it, in writing up the names on the publication for the MIT group, I forgot, left off inadvertently the one name of the BNL, the Brookhaven participant. And I got a letter about that. Okay, so we've treaded our landmines, and now we have to write the story in 2,000 words or less. That's about 2 magazine pages. We used to be able to write stories that were about 1 magazine page, and then physics got more complicated, more specialized, and it seemed like it took longer. And I think our record length news story was 5 pages, which is really too much for anyone to want to read. So we have a pretty much of a limit of 2 pages for our news stories. But it's not easy, because physics has become more specialized, and sometimes just to explain something in one field and why it's significant to someone in another field, you have to give them some background. And I took some examples. Actually, all of these are specifically from condensed matter. So, you know, here's something we reporting on. The energy gap in the normal phase of underdoped high-temperature superconductors. So there's a lot of qualifications there that you have to get past. And it turns out this is still very interesting, that in these high-temperature superconductors, above the temperature where they go superconducting, the electrons seem to already be pairing up in some way. And the nature of that state is not known, but it's considered to be quite significant. Evidence for a Luttinger liquid in a quantum Hall edge state formed by cleave overgrowth technique. Okay, again, a lot of jargon to get through. and to explain to someone before they can understand, they have to know why, what's in Luttinger liquid, so you can explain why it was really neat that they were able to find this technique to grow a really perfect little one-dimensional array of electrons to show that electrons are interacting in, according to the predictions made years ago. The longitudinal resistivity of a two-dimensional electron gas exhibits a strong anisotropy at filling factors of 9½ and 11½. this is a two-dimensional gas where you seem to have more resistance in one direction if you send current in one direction than if you send current orthogonal to it. And there's otherwise no anisotropy of the sample. And that, I think, remains a puzzle today. Okay, so we write the story somehow, we make it short enough, then we send it out for checking. So typically I will have interviewed maybe 10 people as background for a story, including the people who did the work. And I'll send it to each one of those 10 people for checking. And that used to be just the worst period of time. You send out this story and then you'd like, cross your fingers that you got it right, and that people aren't going to be mad for one reason or another. But again, they're very helpful. Anything from correcting typos to gross physics errors. We really pride ourselves on being correct and being pretty technically sound. Being a monthly does have the advantage that we can send it off to all these people, make sure that the physics is correct. And then there, people are also commenting on the tone. They may have said, well, you shouldn't have played up that experiment so much. It's got problems. Or they'll say, well, we think you underplayed this. The balance is wrong somehow. Someone says, well, you forgot to mention so-and-so's work altogether. So we get all these comments and then do our best to address them and make this story the way it adjusted so it's good. And again, another lesson I learned early on was don't hesitate to rewrite because it always gets better. Okay, so here's a sort of an interesting comment I got once. And it was on a really trivial thing I had written. This was in 1971, and we had run two pieces, one advocating the SALT II treaty for nuclear disarmament, and the other one opposing it. And my job was really easy. I just had to write this little box saying what are the terms of the treaty. So I sent it off just as routine checking to the two people who had written the articles, Wolfgang Panofsky, who was in favor of the treaty, and Edward Teller, who was opposed to the treaty. And I said, you know, I just want to see, you know, is this box correct? And Panofsky got right back and said, you know, it's fine. And then I get a call from Edward Teller. Well. We have a basic problem, and I don't think it can be resolved. Silence. I said, oh, well, do you think we could talk about it a little bit? So I can get an idea. What did I say wrong? Val, I don't think that there should be a treaty. So I don't think there should be a box about what's in the treaty. Some things you just have to deal with. He didn't have a right to tell us what goes in or doesn't go in. He can make comments if he wants to about what's there. Okay, the final thing is to be careful and check your work. We all have to check our work, right? And I just have to show you a few times I didn't do that sufficiently well. Okay, the one I still feel really bad about was one of the favorite stories I ever did, was about the ozone depletion in Antarctica, because it was a great experiment. They had gotten all kinds of people down there. They were taking data from satellites and from airplanes, and great peril to fly through these clouds in the middle of winter, and they had ground-based observation. They put all this evidence together, and they really unraveled the problem of what was depleting the ozone. And the centerpiece of this whole work, really, was showing an anti-correlation between measurements of chlorine monoxide and ozone. So this is, obviously, you know there's going to be a mistake coming here, because we eventually ran the correct, this is what we should have run from the start. It shows in the winter time, before the sun comes up in the Antarctic, there's lots of chlorine monoxide, red, toward the South Pole. So at the higher latitudes, you had increased elevations of chlorine monoxide. So the system was loaded with chlorine monoxide. The ozone level is pretty steady. As soon as the sun comes up, that enables the chlorine monoxide to be an effective catalyst in destroying the ozone. So there's this really nice exact anti-correlation between the chlorine monoxide and the ozone levels, just exact anti-correlation. Well, in those days, the way we did color illustrations was to take it to the art director. He would, if you had one curve in one color, it was on its own transparent overlay, so that there was one page with the basic black graph on it, and then there was an overlay with a blue curve, and above that an overlay with a red curve. And I looked at it and I said, looks great, let's go. Oh, and I didn't see color. I was just seeing the black lines. But each overlay was labeled that this should be published in red and this should be published in blue. We have color now, which is much nicer. Well, the artists, when I had given them the drawing and I gave it to them in black and white, they were tracing the curve that should be blue on the overlay, and they were coming down here, and da-da-da-da-da. And then they made a mistake. They said, oh no, which way does it go, there or there? So what came out was, as you guessed, it's still an anti-correlation, but it doesn't give you a lot of ozone depletion at the poles. So I remember getting to the office when the first pages arrived in our office and opening and just being horrified. I had to call the researcher who did this and tell him. It had not yet appeared, actually, in one of the geophysical journals. And he was even more sick than I was. He now talks to me, though. The other, a little more humorous, this one wasn't so much my fault. This was an article on sonoluminescence, which is a neat effect, where you have a liquid which you vibrate with sound waves, and you can cause bubbles to form. And if you adjust the pressure and the frequencies just right, you can get a single bubble that expands and contracts and expands and contracts. And when it contracts, it emits a visible light. The problem is, we had this pretty nice picture of this guy looking at this sonoluminescing bubble. But when it got to the printer says, ooh, what's that spot? And they just totally airbrushed out the luminescing bubble. So this, they didn't check with us. These poor guys forever staring into space. But the worst one is probably concerns a special issue we had on superconductivity. And we, of course, one of the neat things is levitation. And we had several pictures, both of which were pretty dramatically showed the phenomenon of levitation. In one, we had a picture of a goldfish in a bowl, and it was on a magnetic base, and it was levitating. The other was a picture of a director of the Japanese superconducting research lab in Tokyo, Soji Tanaka, and he's standing on a platform and he's being levitated. And we debated back and forth. We were going to go with the guy standing on the platform, and we wrote the figure caption for that. You know where this is headed. But the last minute, we decided to go with the goldfish. So the caption says, Levitation at ISTEC, the International Superconductivity Technology Center in Japan, da 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 da. Last October, the laboratory's director, Soji Tanaka, was levitated. They never wrote to us. I don't know. Okay. So that's all I was going to share with you. But I'm happy to have any more questions or suggestions for physics today. Yes?
Just to comment, you are in good company in erasing a bright spot. There is a famous story in the 60s, 1960s. The first observation of harmonic generation by focusing a laser beam in a piece of quartz or something like that. And at that time, they were presented plates, spectroscopic plates, okay? Mm-hmm. And there was exactly the same story. The printer say, oh, what is this spot here? It's a piece of dust, and he just erased it. So if you go to the Physical Review Letters in 60 by Franken, which is the first evidence of creating the second harmonic generation of light, you will find this evidence without any evidence. So you are in good company.
It's good to know we're in good company. Yeah.
So, yes. I'm just curious, it's just a general question about physics today in general. How does physics today see itself in comparison or contrast with something similar but different, like, say, physics world from the IOP? Are those apples and oranges, or are those?
No, I think they're very similar. You know, they're put out by the Institute of Physics, and we're put out by the American Institute of Physics, which are comparable organizations. I think we feel some heat from them.
Some competition.
Of course, they have more of a European perspective, and we hope to appeal to the world. We have a problem of getting on-time distribution to people in Europe or Japan. That's been a problem. Hopefully the internet gives them the distribution, certainly sooner than the post office can.
But in principle, do you two have the same target?
I think we are. Yeah, it's been, that's what I would conclude from having read Physics World. Yeah. Yes?
Have you ever been people have ever attempted to bribe you or something?
Me in particular?
No, Search and Discovery, of course, has a big particular role. It's interesting you mentioned the Physics World, which I think is a very nice magazine and the regular articles. They don't have quite the same take on, I think they might give a recent discovery, Search and Discovery, but they don't do it in the Physics Today style, which is very much interviewing the community, getting a lot of comments, you know, stuff like this. But occasionally one hears out in the street, so to speak, about the fact that groups really, for this intermediate between breakdowns and breakthroughs, nothing's happening for a couple of months, and you presumably have a certain number of topics that you're planning to discuss or maybe discuss it or something, and that you people apply pressure and stuff like this, or push their case a lot.
We have people who push their cases, but I think we're pretty aware of who the people are who push their own work, and we have long since learned to take their advice or their pushing with a grain of salt. You know, we try to treat everybody the same. If they're pushing something, we'll look into it, but just because they're pushing, we try not to go with that pressure. I worry about the hit and miss nature of what we do run. We have about 5 people who regularly report on the physics news. Most of those have a heavier burden than I do in editing articles also. So it's actually, well, it comes down to what the individual reporter has found and has come up with. And so what we do with our meetings, we bring to the table pieces of work that we have individually found. And then the group decides which ones are the most significant that we really ought to be covering. There may be some things that are significant that didn't get to that table because we just are infallible and are fallible human beings and just haven't found them. But you know, it's we do try to get a distribution of the range of physics represented by our member societies, and that's geophysics and optics and acoustics and rheology and you know, lots of member societies that we, if we've gone a number of months without doing anything geophysics, we'll make a particular effort to make sure we know what's going on in geophysics. Yes?
Have you ever had anyone try to pass off on you a story which turned out to be a deliberate hoax? I don't mean like the Schoen stuff, but something that they never actually intended to publish in a scientific journal.
Yeah, joke. Yeah.
A joke? A joke? Fortunately not. Are you considering that?
Could have a conspiracy, a bunch of us would
agree. So everyone I call will say it's really... I tried to get us to put out an April Fool's issue once, but that's a little dicey.
That's a good idea.
Yes?
Did that Schoen story change how you work at all? Would it happen again?
I can't say it would not happen again. We also had done a story about the discovery of that new element. And you know, that's a sad case, of course, and you know, there was a whole team of people who thought it was right, and just one person with the computer files who was fiddling with the data. I can't say it wouldn't happen again. I feel that we're pretty conservative in our selection of stories by talking to as many people in the community as we do. I don't know how we prevent that. Because as I said, if the other rest of the community isn't picking up on it, it's hard to expect us to. I mean, that's passing it back, but. No, I guess we're not. Yes?
I would like to go on this question. Normally, it's not your responsibility because you are reporting on things which are already being evaluated by regular review, like physical review letters or Nature or whoever. Are there cases where you have doubts instead of the fact that it passed the refereeing system of reviews, of major reviews? Does it happen?
I had doubts about the sun of fusion. You know, this was the sun of luminescence where they claimed that the bubble as it was collapsing was actually causing the fusion of deuterium that was contained within the bubble. But many people I talked to did also. I thought that was just a terribly written paper. Then I was surprised it was accepted, but I can't remember any time that I thought the work was not good when the other people in the community were saying it was good. I have had the case of people have written a perspective for Science or Nature, commenting on a published paper in Science or Nature, and when I call them about it to say, you know, is this something we should be running? They'll often say, well, that was asked to write that perspective, but I don't think the work is that significant, or things like that. So sometimes you get a very different reaction when you actually talk to the people. But my feeling is that I'm not an expert in any of these fields, and it's not really my job to be the judgment. It's my job to pass on the consensus of the community out there, and I just feel that I shouldn't be the one passing judgment. Judgment does come in that I won't even look at a story and call people about it unless it in some way speaks to me. And sometimes I just don't know enough. And sometimes people then will call and say, this is really a good story, and I never would have known it.
Physics Today is, like many American journals, but Physics Today is sort of a world journal now, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. We like to think so,
You don't feel you're representing the North American community.
No.
So I was just trying to think in terms of, because I know coal gases have been very nicely served by Search and Discovery, like with many, many articles of BBC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's such that if we don't see one every 2 or 3 months, we're sort of bothered. But in any event, I was just trying to think in some of the more recent work, particularly on the BCS-BBC crossover, which occurred all very quickly in many different groups. When you phone up experts, you phone up experts in Europe just as easily as you do in North America. I mean, there's no slight preference for cheaper calls to the United States.
No, but I will admit that I prefer to make a call. Especially if I'm checking out the story, I like the information contained in the tone of voice. Oh, that's really important. Oh, yeah, I guess that's important. You know, you can tell a lot from the tone of voice or the long pause, the telling pause. So,
let me shut the door.
Yeah. So, but especially since I'm on the West Coast here, and it's 9 hours difference to Germany, very often I will send an email. Sometimes I'll say, you could answer this question or tell me the best time to call you. And if I can, I'll call them. I don't worry about the phone call. But for Japan, it's really hard because of the time difference. So I'm much more likely to send an email to someone in Japan. But one thing that hinders me, and we need to address it more, is I don't know who's who in Japan as much as I do in both Europe and the U.S. So I don't always know who to contact. Yes?
So do you actually travel to topical meetings to also understand what the most important questions are the division heads for different subjects the ones to travel, or how does that work?
We don't travel that much because we don't have that big a budget. It's rare to go to a more specialized meeting. Of course, I'm able to come out here to KITP to specialize meetings all the time, which is nice. But the meeting I have tended to attend in recent years is March meeting of the American Physical Society, where a lot of condensed matter is reported. I've been to Division of Atomic and Molecular and Optical Physics meetings. We try to get people to the acoustic meeting once a year or so. We'll try to get someone to the Geophysical Society meeting. We try to get them to those broader meetings whenever we can. Mm-hmm. And those are important just for even just meeting people face-to-face and making contacts. But we don't get to travel to very many meetings. We just don't have that big a budget.
So if there's a new emerging field of physics, like biophysics, for example, then you would actually just get what you can from the March meeting or make attempts to go to other bio-related conferences?
I guess it depends on the specific meeting. We have sent people to specialized meetings when we felt that it was a really important topic.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's made on a real case-by-case basis. But you may not realize of all the money you pay to join, say, American Physical Society to get your Physics Today, Physics Today only gets, I think, like $2 or $2.50 of all of your dues money.
So we really are poor.
So you live off that?
Well, we actually used to in the real early days, but not since. We're really subsidized by the American Institute of Physics. They realize we're the most valuable product they have to offer to their member societies. And for American Physical Society, and they know that in membership polls, the members tell them that the most valuable service that APS gives them is providing physics today.
By that subsidy, you mean that $2.50 per membership, or you mean something in addition?
No, per membership. The American Physical Society would be in favor of raising that, but some of the other societies, like Geophysical Society, for whose members were not quite as valuable, have opposed that increasing that amount. So it's a sort of a political issue.
So the reason it works now is your costs are low because you rely on outsiders and unpaid contributions.
Yeah, we don't pay anyone for writing an article for us. So when we have a fairly small staff, 15 to 20 people, and of those, I think five write for the news section, the hard news, a couple more for the quote softer news issues and events.
So if Physics Today had double the budget, what would
it do? Yeah, I would hope that they would have many more reporters from the news section. And there's occasionally new sections we've talked about, like something that's focused more on the human side, maybe people doing unusual things with their physics. Some kind of profiles would be very interesting. We used to run Physicists in Unusual Occupation. That was a very popular feature. Did you have in mind some endowment?
Just like say, over many years, I've read Physics Today dutifully, and I've read many articles by you, as well as your collaborator, particularly you, on various topics that sometimes I didn't know very much about, but also topics I did know a lot about. And often topics sometimes where I knew a lot about and I also knew it was confusing, you know, that if I talked to my fellow theorists, they wouldn't understand very well. And I've always been amazed at how well you do. So I think you're really what the Japanese would call a national treasure.
Well, thank you. But as I said,
I must say, I don't quite see the same quality in maybe some of the other writers, but maybe they also have so much experience.
Well, experience, and as I said, I think what I write can only reflect how well my informers have been able to inform me. And so I give a lot of credit right back to the community.
Well, that's all I think, Barbara.
Okay, thank you.